You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. We live in a time of considerable intolerance towards free speech, on campus, and increasingly in broader society as well. But just how widespread is this situation, and how did we get here? I'm Madeline Grant, Digital Officer at the IEA. Today I'm joined by Claire Fox, Director of the Academy of Ideas, and Christian Niemitz, the IEA's Head of Health and Welfare. They examine so-called Generation Snowflake, a term often used to describe a perceived millennial distrust in free expression. They take a look at how common these views actually are amongst the young, how seriously we should take them, and who else may be to blame for this culture of intolerance. They also look at the way free speech has come to be disparaged as a ploy of the far right, rather than considered a universal value. If you like what you hear, subscribe to our podcast channel, IEA Conversations. To what extent do you think we are facing a crisis of free speech on campuses today?
It is a very serious problem. Ironically, the more it's been identified, the more there's a kickback. One of the things that's annoying me at the moment is people who are saying, actually, there's no crisis of free speech on campus. It's exaggerated, it's used for political ends. But actually, historically, we've never seen, I think, something where there's such widespread support for closing down debate. It's the default position that if there's an opinion that you don't like, that you find offensive, an entirely subjective term, that you'll close it down. And it's become mainstream policy to have safe spaces, and they are organised around the idea of keeping out ideas or people who will disturb the peace of people who will have a similar outlook. So that's a very different phenomenon than just the no platforming situation. So yes, I think you could say it's a crisis.
It's often compared to Puritans. I've heard it compared to the Salem witch trials. People are not over-exaggerating when they make these comparisons.
Well, of course, there's a certain amount of hyperbole in relation to that. But I actually think that the Cultural Revolution in China might be more of a sort of similar kind of comparison. And that sounds full of hyperbole as well, doesn't it? But the Cultural Revolution was where the young were incited by certain sections of the establishment to turn on their elders and to denounce them and to kind of demand a certain way of looking at the world. Only one view was feasible. And it can feel like that on campuses at the moment. You know, there are witch hunts, but obviously nobody's burnt, but reputations are sullied, in fact, sometimes completely torn to shreds. And I think that what we have at the moment is this phenomenon of calling out, denouncing people entirely arbitrarily for things which suddenly do not pass muster in a kind of set of arbitrary rules about what you can and can't say, what you can and can't think, in fact. And so at any one time, you can be called out. Once that happens on a campus, you can find it very easy to suddenly, you know, think something trivial, a group of students saying that your views on colonialism, your views on environmentalism, whatever it is, are unacceptable. And then that turns into a kind of widespread demonisation. And of course, that's then amplified with the help of social media, and that can turn very nasty indeed.
Yeah. And there are examples of, you know, like the Tim Hunt example, within days, I think, of him making these comments, which were, when you see the context, completely different to the way that they were portrayed in the media and by his critics. But within days of making these comments, with no kind of due process, he'd been unceremoniously sacked from a number of different positions. And eventually there was a counter backlash. But I'm sure for every Tim Hunt, there are many more people that don't get the public coming back on their side to restore their reputation.
But yes, that's the problem. The difficulty with somebody like Tim Hunt, for example, is in fact it only took for him to get on a plane to leave Korea to get back to the UK, when he discovered that he'd walked into a kind of international accusation that he was a misogynist and anti-women in science. He wasn't sacked. What happened was that he had a number of honorary positions which he removed from, but it's effectively the same thing. He then suddenly finds that he's not invited to major science and medical and cancer conferences. And here you have a leading professor who has dedicated his later years in science to going around schools talking to young women about getting involved in science, being called out as a sexist and a misogynist. Even the counter backlash doesn't restore the damage, because at that point, your life has been more or less effectively preyed upon and looked over, and you're seen to have all sorts of views that you don't have. he's actually left the country now. And so he's not the Tim Hunt that he was. Sir Tim yeah. Hunt is now not going around schools, giving talks. Oh. He's left the country. His wife got a position, I think, in Japan. He said that he chose to go because he couldn't face it anymore. He couldn't stand it. You know, people's lives are, in that sense, destroyed, even when their reputation is restored. But in most instances, the reputation isn't restored because there's some kind of nasty taste in the mouth about someone who's been called out. The other thing that happens, of course, is that you can have a minor skirmish at a university campus in which an academic is identified as being somehow malevolent or on the wrong side of a set of political views that are now considered the orthodoxy. And they might not lose their job and they might have tenure and so on, but they're warned, aren't they, to be quiet. And that means they have to walk on eggshells. There's a kind of chilling effect. And it also has the impact on other academics that should they have such unacceptable views. And it's not just academics, but you can feel yourself that you walk on eggshells in a range of ways rather than upsetting the particular group that might go for you.
Yeah. And Christian, you've spent quite a lot of time looking at the history of particularly left-wing movements on campuses and off campus as well. I'm interested to know how much of this is a new phenomenon, because obviously students particularly are very well known for adopting extreme positions that they will later grow out of or kind of moderate as they get a bit older. Do you think that what we're seeing is unprecedented?
Wouldn't say unprecedented, but it is clearly getting more extreme, and that's not a coincidence. It has to get more extreme. There is a reason for that. I can't take the stated views of social justice activists completely at face value. It's easier to make sense of it if you think of it as a form of status signaling. Woke opinions are a status symbol. When we hear a term like status symbol, we think of something like a Rolex watch or a Ferrari, but it doesn't have to be that, a rather old-fashioned form of status signaling where status means wealth. It can also mean other things. And at least in those social circles, people derive their social status from having woke, trendy views. The trouble with that is that if you use your views to signal moral superiority, well, you can only be morally superior if there is someone who is morally inferior. It's relative and inherently scarce, moral superiority. So you need to find something more extreme all the time, especially when you're winning. When your views become the mainstream view, and if you want to stay ahead of the curve, then you need to find a new offence, something else to be outraged about. And that's exactly what we observe. That's why there is some new offence pretty much every week. Last month's witch hunt will now have become mainstream already. So therefore, you have to constantly keep moving. You need a moving target in order to stay ahead of the curve.
That's interesting. So because views that were once progressive are now mainstream, gay marriage was brought in several years ago by a conservative government, and vast majority of the public now support these sorts of values. They have to kind of, are you saying, move the goalposts a little bit so that for every kind of progressive goodie, there has to be a conservative baddie that you demonise in turn?
Yes, absolutely. You need a group of people who are deemed morally inferior, because that's how status signalling works. If everyone had a Rolex watch or if everyone had a Ferrari, it would no longer be a symbol of wealth. It derives that value from the fact that most people don't have it. With progressive views, the trouble is that they're much easier to acquire than an old-fashioned status symbol. You just need to say that you're outraged about something. You just need to say that you find something problematic or whatever the term of the week is. And since it is so easy to imitate, the mainstream quickly catches up and you have to keep moving.
Can I say a but? Yeah. Because I think the thing is that this is derived from what people consider to be real politics. So they don't see themselves as playing a game. There is undoubtedly a kind of opportunistic group that kind of jump on the latest thing. But I think one of the core intellectual underpinnings of this is identity politics. We have to understand that to understand why these things are so deeply felt. So first of all, identity politics, in exactly the way that you just discussed in terms of status symbols, the thing which is most valorized in society today is victimhood. The more that you can say that you've suffered or that you're a victim of, that is given by society a fair amount of credit. that in some ways incites people to find their own victimhood. And then identity politics means that people look to their particular identity or define themselves through the prism of identity rather than ideals or principles or ideology or any of the things that historically...
Or expertise
or anything. But, you know, you don't say even... I'm a conservative and I've read these books and I've thought about this and this is where I've ended up. Or I'm a Marxist because I've read these books and this is where I've ended up. Or you know, I belong to this church or I'm in a trade. Things that transcend your identity in a way. Yeah. That you kind of become part of a group. You start to identify with a set of views or beliefs. This is different. This is your identity given to you. So you say, in my instance, you know, as a woman, I find that offensive. And then it will be... As an Irish woman, I find that offensive. Or I could then say, well, I was brought up in Wales, so I can add that in. As a Welsh-Irish woman, you know, as a woman from, you know, a working class background. So you accrue these identities and they give you a certain amount of authority because then that seems to be suggesting that you understand more than anyone else the particular brand of oppression that's inflicted on the groups. And, of course, we're aware of this in relation to the kind of racialising of anti-racism, which has not become now a commitment to fighting for equality, that people are not treated differently because of the colour of their skin, but rather an emphasis on one's skin colour, one's ethnicity, as a way of saying, I have a unique and privileged way of discussing this that you don't, and therefore I can silence you. Exactly, shut up.
Yeah.
So that's really problematic. But the problem with that then is that if it's your identity, it becomes very personal. The I'm offended bit, if you actually do genuinely start to identify this is who you are, then me criticising your views becomes me criticising you. So it appears indistinguishable that I'm saying, but that's a nonsense argument that you've just put forward about immigration. Immediately it becomes a, how can you say that? That's, you know, now, you know, my people, we're oppressed, you know, you're a racist because you don't understand, you've got no right to say that. And it's taken much more to heart. So in that sense, it's become quite genuine. And that's what's so scary, because it's not even that superficial.
So it's every attack can only ever be an ad hominem.
Well, it feels as though that's the way it feels like other reasons. Yes,
Can I just clarify? When I say people use these views for status signalling, I'm not suggesting that they're being dishonest. I'm not suggesting that they secretly believe the opposite and just say that to look good. You can talk yourself into a righteous rage. And if you know that your social status depends on it, at least in certain circles, then that can be a strong incentive. It's like with certain forms of music or culture that you first look around what is considered high status, what is highly valued among in my peer group, and then you start actually liking it.
My view on this is that actually in itself, there are some decent elements of intersectionality. Some of it is simply being a good person, like imagining what other people might have been through, trying to be considerate. The problem is not that people go speaking as a gay man necessarily or speaking as a woman. It's because what often follows it is, I find that offensive, therefore shut up. And I think there are also cases where we create a hierarchy of grievance based on identity, but often we get it very badly wrong. One really good example of this, it's a great video, I would recommend anyone to go and watch it. There was a debate going on between the historian David Starkey and the journalist Laurie Penny at a literary festival. Midway through her speech, she suddenly decides to kind of check David Starkey's privilege. And he goes absolutely berserk. He reminds her that despite his plummy accent, he grew up in abject poverty in the north of England. His father had to have all of his teeth removed because it was too expensive to go to the dentist. His mother swept floors for a living. And whereas, in comparison, Laurie Penny lived a very charmed life, in our focus on particular labels and signals, we overlook other really important things. I think perhaps class is more important a signaler than gender, but we focus to the exclusion of other things.
The point that you make about intersectionality having some possible positives, although I'm less convinced. But of course, empathy has always been a hugely important aspect of one's capacity to be human and communicate. And anyone who's kind of got a tin ear and doesn't understand other people's experiences won't get very far, in my opinion, in terms of changing the world. But the problem we've got is that we all have very different experiences. So if the only truth is your experience, then it makes it impossible for somebody else to even have empathy with you, because actually that's not allowed either. Actually, these days it could be called cultural appropriation, or, you know, you could end up falling foul of something. And the example that you give, which actually I was in the audience of that event.
Oh, really?
And in the video, there's somebody screaming from the audience, and that's me, because I could see what was happening. David Starkey was also being set up in order to deflect from an argument that Laurie Penny wanted to make without any opportunity for anyone to come back on it. She set up an enemy in David Starkey. Also, when he then reacted in the way he did, she went on to write about that and to say on social media that this was sexist bullying. And she, in fact, was the bully because she was, to the audience, signalling that this was a white man, privileged and so on and so forth. And in the intersectional hierarchy, he signalled this and that she was in a more oppressed role. As you say, he overthrew that, but he didn't really because the audience didn't know what to do. But the point is, Laurie Penny does not represent all women. She only has to stand on what she says, but we were meant to take her side as against this white privileged man. As you point out, then you have the unsavoury spectacle of, in order for him to defend himself, he has to lay out his wounds. And I don't blame him. That's what you have to do. But isn't that disgusting? Because we'd gone to a debate on national identity and ideas, and I was actually personally interested in hearing what they had to say. I wasn't interested in taking sides about who was more oppressed or whether Starkey had more brownie points for his oppression. Actually, he wasn't just a white man, really, he's gay and he suffered in his childhood. So I agree that intersectionality doesn't capture the subtleties of people's identity anyway. But anyway, that's just not the basis on which I think we should hold each other to account.
Yeah, as long as you're talking about purely subjective experience of something, then I guess it's fine to stress your identity. But not everything is just about personal experience. In fact, your personal experience in most respects will be hugely unrepresentative. Somebody else in exactly the same position who ticks the exact same boxes will have completely different experience. And when we're discussing things like discrimination, gender pay gap, whatever it is, those things are to a huge extent empirical questions. They're measurable. It's not about saying, yeah, but I have this identity, therefore I can speak with greater authority. No, you can't. There are economic models that, for example, split the gender pay gap into its different components, and they do find that discrimination is at best a very tiny proportion of it. Most of it is really the result of different choices and so forth. That's an empirical question. Of course, you can criticize the empirical evidence. You can say, I've seen a different model which says something else. That's fine. But it's not about your personal identity.
It is quite hard to quantify, but I'm interested also in the extent to which this snowflake culture, which is a term that I think I believe you coined originally, Claire, how mainstream that is. I left university in 2014, at which point all of the trigger warning and no platform stuff was well underway. There was actually a debate in my final year that a feminist group managed to get cancelled because it was about abortion, but because both of the speakers were male, how could they possibly understand any of the moral issues around abortion? And the debate didn't go ahead. At the same time, most of my peers were barely aware of these political conversations that were taking place. Most of them were just at uni to try and get through their exams, have a nice time, make some friends. Is there perhaps a danger that in stereotyping an entire large group of people that we may end up creating a kind of anti-snowflake backlash?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a danger of that. And it's not a phrase that I created, but I'm, according to Wikipedia, responsible for introducing it into the UK. I was just actually using it in my book because it's a phrase that had been used in America on the campus wars there, and I was kind of explaining what it meant. But certainly I agree that I've now been responsible for making it a widespread insult in the UK, which there's even a snowflake hotline on The Sun, you know. And of course it's used in a disparaging way. It's used to dismiss a whole generation. But one of the points I was trying to make in the book, which I still think is true, is there's a generational trend. Generational trends don't encompass everybody in that generation, but they're the dominant intellectual trend. And I think that the notion of the easily offended is more prevalent in the young. And this is why we have to be careful. You know, for every campus spat, as you say, that hits the headlines, and now because there's more knowledge about it, the newspapers will pick up on the more egregious, ludicrous examples. That can feel like, if you're a mainstream student, you're thinking, oh, that's just those lunatics over there who are doing that. That's nothing to do with us and our generation. But two important factors. One is that actually many students feel inhibited in the way they speak and behave and the ways that they explore ideas at university because of this atmosphere. And they will quietly say that to you. So it's not that they would be student activists on either side of these debates, but they're not free to just speak freely in seminars or even in the bar. Increasingly, what's being policed, by the way, is social activities. So although, again, these are kind of the more infamous ones, like, you know, the Mexican-themed party that gets accused of being cultural appropriation and racist, even though it's organised by the local Mexican restaurant that's, guess what, run by Mexicans. But nonetheless, a big furore happens. So the students who've organised that get branded as racist, it gets called off and all of the usual things. And there's loads of examples of that. So they're not political students, right? These are guys kind of organising social events. Every party that's got a fancy dress theme now is subject to policing. Actually, this touches many more students than simply those involved in the disputes themselves. And more worryingly, has a chilling effect on their academic life, because lecturers are very nervous about touching on what they consider to be controversial issues, pussyfoot around in preference to trying to provoke a discussion in their seminar group. They're actually trying to avoid offending anyone in the seminar group. Also, on certain issues, I think everyone has internalised a sense of the notion of fragility and vulnerability. I think that's a much more widespread generational phenomenon, this idea of not coping. You know, 78% of students reported to the NUS that they had mental health problems in the year previously. 78%. That is untenable. I don't mean it's a scientific study, it's entirely based on their subjective replies. But the fact that they think they have mental health problems indicates that they see themselves in kind of vulnerable terms, have pathologized the vicissitudes of everyday life and exam stress and not having enough money when you're a student. They see that as them being hard done to, and they can't cope with it. And that is partly Generation Snowflake too.
Yeah. But I think we also do have to hold the generation that allows this to happen to account too. For every Blurred Lines song that gets banned, there is usually a grown-up, there's a vice-chancellor, there's a professor who has allowed this to happen and has facilitated it.
So much of the contemporary argument is not young people fighting against an older generation, but rather ventriloquising the views of a particular group of adults. And that particular group of adults, which is a slightly different point, intellectually turned against Enlightenment thinking and Western thought, and are the woke sense of which we kind of joke about, started off with the combination of postmodernism, with the rejection of intellectual and political trends that were universalist, yeah, and went into a particularist mode. This is now being taken to its logical extreme. Similarly, in relation to the mental health fragility point, the older generation have socialised young people into imagining that everything in the world is scary. The things are getting worse, that, you know, sugary drinks are going to kill you, obesity is going to kill you, paedophiles are going to kill you. Everything is a threat. Everything is exaggerated and catastrophized. Young people grow up thinking that safety as an end is a worthwhile pursuit. So not surprisingly, they go to university and say, we demand, and they say it really vigorously, we demand safe spaces. And it's extraordinary that an 18-year-old would see as the most important value that they'd have at, yeah, university is safety. But in that sense, they're only aping what they've actually been reared with. They're not even rebelling. I want them to rebel against this.
On the surface, at least, this doesn't necessarily seem to touch upon that many areas of our lives. If it's mostly an issue of campus movements, why should we be so concerned about it?
Well, there's a very interesting example of how dangerous this road and where it can lead us in the issue of the Scottish prankster, YouTube prankster Count Dankler, who made a particularly ridiculous YouTube video of himself training his girlfriend's pug dog to do a Nazi salute. He did this by using a horrible phrase, which I'm going to say, which was, instead of saying, sit up, boy, he said, gas the Jews. Now, obviously, for a dog, sit up, boy, gas the Jews, no difference, right? He says at the beginning of the video that his girlfriend is always telling him how cute this ugly dog is, and he wanted to teach the dog to do the least cute thing in the world. So, in other words, he says at the beginning, the least cute thing in the world is Nazis and Z-Kyles and all the rest of it. And then the dog proceeds to do kind of imitation Z-Kyles every time that horrible phrase is used, right? This is not my idea of a fun thing to do on a Saturday afternoon, and the video went viral, but it was prosecuted by the Scottish courts. This is the most important thing. This is unprecedented, by the way. And he was found guilty. He therefore faces prison for something which the judge said it didn't matter what the context was, that he knew that he wasn't being a Nazi. The dog can't be a Nazi. But that didn't matter. It was offensive. And in the whole discussion, there were all those phrases like, it could cause psychological harm. Some people will find this offensive. People might hear it out of context and so on. Free speech activists are rightly up in arms about the dangerous precedent of where we end up. A lot of comedians have supported Cam Dankler, Ricky Gervais and various people. Lots of comedians haven't, because they've said, oh, we don't want to support him because Tommy Robinson, he supports him. We don't want to be seen to be associated with him, so we're not going to support this case at all. We don't want anyone to think that we're a Nazi. You've then had a range of articles that have been written on the back of this, quite preposterously, which say those who shout free speech the loudest are simply doing so in order to give justification for the freedom to express bigoted views.
Yeah, I've come across that argument as well, that free speech is really just a form of dog whistling. If you talk about free speech, what you really want to do is you want to legitimize far-right propaganda. But what's particularly strange about this court ruling here about the Nazi Park is that this is actually something that would have been, I'm pretty sure it would have been legal even in Germany and Austria, where there really are strict rules against the use of Nazi symbols and slogans, anything that could be construed as relativizing Nazi crimes. But if it's clear from the context that this is a joke, even if it's a poor taste joke, that is perfectly legal. And comedians have been doing this for as long as I can remember. That's always been a staple of comedy. There's some way of making jokes of about Nazism, and this would be one of those.
It's extraordinary what's been achieved in terms of changing what words actually mean. So in some ways, in this call for safe spaces, trigger warnings, etc., you see them invoking almost like the J.S. Mill, the harm principle, except for whereas the harm principle referred to physical violence, it now refers to emotional harm. They've shifted the goalposts, and because it's all so subjective, you can't argue against it. What worries me is that these groups have done such a good job of kind of unravelling meaning and creating new boundaries for acceptable behaviour, that it's going to be such an uphill task to unravel this, because you're not just unravelling people's behaviour, but you're unravelling an entire culture and an entire mode of thought. And I think we probably all agreed that it's not just the young people that are responsible for this. It goes back to mollycoddled parenting and lax professors who allow this stuff to take place. So I don't even know where we would begin.
The no platforming thing is also justified in the same terms, that if a certain speaker is allowed to go ahead and express their ideas, that would create an unsafe environment that members of certain communities might feel threatened. But I find that hard, again, to take that entirely at face value, especially if you look at the sort of people who get no platformed. It isn't just people like Milo Yiannopoulos who really do come, of course, to university campus in order to provoke people. It's usually people who are incredibly right on, who have very fashionable views, who just on one particular issue once said something that is now no longer compatible with what you nowadays expected to say. So people like Jermaine Greer, what's a comedian, Kate Smurthwaite, has been no platform. This is really not a controversial person. She is actually super right on, very much in line with current orthodoxy. It's just on one issue that she said something probably even careless, don't know. But if you argue that you feel unsafe, that you cannot bear the thought to be in the same building as that person, how on earth can you bear to be in a supermarket or on a train or on a bus? That's why I don't take this at face value. I don't believe it. I don't believe that people genuinely feel unsafe when they're around Jermaine Greer or Kate Smurthwaite. Otherwise, you could never leave your campus.
Yeah, well, to a certain extent, I'm afraid some of them are actually retreating in a way that they aren't leaving anywhere. I mean, that's one of the difficulties. But I think that what we've got is something that a professor, Nick Haslam, has described as concept creep. Concept creep means that certain terms and the lack of meaning, everything has expanded beyond sense, but nonetheless now incorporates harm. So bullying or harm itself, hate speech, now encompasses just everything you don't like. The police and the criminal justice service have incorporated student unions' woke interpretations of hate into the law. So we're talking a serious problem, right? This is not being confined to campus. The police themselves, if you look at their definition of a hate crime, use all of the same terminology about, you know, there's no need for evidence, this has to be defined by the individual, you shouldn't challenge them. You might wonder why there's a spike in hate crimes at any given point. It's because what you're describing is just somebody phoning up and saying somebody was horrible, you know, that somebody used hate speech against me. whether it's genuine or not, the concept that things are psychologically harmful, and that being deployed in relation to the J.S. Mill harm principle, which is now common practice amongst free speeches. You know, an awful lot of people on the free speech side now said, well, we have to take this into account as well. So, you know, you're kind of seeing a real slipping away of any kind of sensible concept. This is where they start using science. They say, science has now given us greater insight into psychological harm. J.S. Mill didn't understand it. We now understand how people are damaged psychologically by hearing words or certain views. But it does become absolutely impossible then to say that anyone should be able to speak, if you see what I mean. If you say it's the harm principle, every speaker that you've just mentioned that gets banned is always on the basis that they create psychological harm.
Yes.
The difficulty we now have is that there's also then this range of new crimes. One of the things that's happened that's like the identity politics eating itself is the way the feminist movement is split into 29 variations. And one of the big things now is one's attitude to transgender and the fact that you can be called transphobic, and that just any speaker who does not go along with gender recognition, self-defined, is transphobic. They don't have to have said anything. If you don't agree with that position, you're transphobic.
You have to proactively agree nowadays.
You have
not
to proactively
quietly
agree.
Passively accept it.
And then they say you're transphobic, and then they say, as a consequence, you don't believe that transgender people should exist, therefore you support the Holocaust of transgender people. That, therefore, is going to cause us psychological harm to have that person anywhere near us. Mm. And as though it sounds mad, you can see the logic as it kind of unravels itself. You can then see why walking past a statue of the arch-imperialist and undoubtedly racist Cecil Rhodes, but a statue which was in Oxford for many a year without anyone noticing it, and many people walking past it without anything happening to them because they didn't know who it was, suddenly gets identified. And then students say, walking past a statue is violence, is violence itself. And so the inability to distinguish between a physical and it's psychological, self-defined, subjective feeling is what I think makes this possibly able to run and run. But as I say, the fact that then the establishment incorporates it, you know, the police, although they didn't take down the Cecil Rhodes statue, you go to any museum, you go to any historical establishment in this country, and you'll find that they're worried about their statues. In other words, it's had an impact. The grown-ups are sitting there, seriously sitting around discussing whether if we continue to have the name of this building based on somebody who once had slaves, whether that's going to cause racism in contemporary 2018.
I mentioned earlier that when I was at university, there were some speakers that successfully got an event cancelled. It was on abortion, two male speakers. The truth was that the organisers bowed out because there was the threat of a protest. They didn't actually have to physically go there with their drums and make loads of noise. It was simply the threat that there was to be a protest, and they caved proactively before the event, which suggests that there's a capitulation that has to take place as well. I'm actually interested in Claire, in what you were saying about the way that people have been brought up. I'm probably a product of it, so I'm perhaps not the best person to ask. But even in my lifetime, I've noticed that my nephews, who are in their sort of 5, 6, 7 years old, they are not allowed the same freedoms that I had. And I'm sure I, in turn, there's things that I was not allowed to do that my mum and her generation was. Do you think that plays a big part in it?
Young people have been deprived of the freedoms of growing up and the sense of experimentation by a kind of form of parenting and educational social policy that's overly wanted to protect young people. And that's gone from overprotecting them physically by not allowing them to roam about. The numbers of children who are allowed to walk to school on their own or go playing on their own now is kind of tiny, minuscule of it was in the past. The other side of that, of course, is not just the kind of physical safety, but it's also the psychological safety. And that's the form of the self-esteem movement, which is basically a philosophical point that people could be damaged if you didn't constantly tell them how important they were and that they were the centre of the universe and how good they were. So you've got this toxic mix of kids who are scared and kind of told all the time about threats and don't know how to negotiate them. That's the most important thing on the one hand. On the other hand, also constantly being told they're the centre of the universe, that, you know, that we don't want to damage their self-esteem by criticising them, almost have prizes, give everybody a gold star, even if they come last. also a kind of sense of entitlement that they should be treated in a particular way. Those two things, when they mix up, is where you get Generation Snowflake from.
Yeah, because a lot of the anger of this particular group of students is the fact that life isn't fair, that not everyone can have the best outcome, and also a resistance, seemingly, to judging people by things that are measurable, objective, like ideas and achievement. It could derive partly from quite a kind of left-wing philosophy, but it does also seem to have its roots in this all must have prizes thing, that we must have equality of outcome, not just equality of opportunity.
Yeah, can I just go back for a second to the statues thing?
Yeah.
I think that the reason why this became a thing is that it's endlessly inflatable. The same as with cultural appropriation and microaggression. The beauty of it is that you can find some new microaggression and some new form of cultural appropriation every week if you're looking for it. Almost everything we do is in some way a cultural appropriation. And it's the same with the statues and paintings and street names. Given that these will be representing someone who lived in an earlier century, it's almost guaranteed that they held some view which would nowadays be considered unacceptable. So therefore, this is a field where you can constantly find new things to be offended by. You just need to find out more about the views that that person held. And then you can say, oh, this is now unacceptable because this creates an unsafe environment for this group or that group.
But that also relates, you know, that relates, especially some things like microaggressions, relates to your question about almost have prizes and the kind of expectation that I will be the centre of the universe. One of the things that amused me was when I was doing a talk and a group of students were media students, and there was a kind of serious argument about if you knew what it was like to be young today, you know, and we're all studying journalism, you know, and we're not going to be able to get columns in national newspapers, you know, I mean, it's so hard to get jobs. And I was like, what makes you think there was ever a period in time that anyone was able to get a column in a national newspaper just because they did a course, you know what I mean? Or that everyone's got columns. And there was a sort of sense of, you know, like outrage that everyone can't end up with the same thing. And the reason why that reminds me about the microaggressions is because it becomes the smaller and smaller things all the time. You know, microaggressions are this idea of small slights, but that they add up to something. And the reason why they add up to something is because of very few big slights that most of these people face. Now, you're talking about a very privileged student at Oxford University on a Rhodes Scholarship. But if you say walking past a Rhodes statue, a curriculum that doesn't have enough ethnic minorities on the study list, and so on and so forth, right? You can add all these things up. Or, you know, we went to the canteen and they were serving food that was insulting to our different ethnic groups and its cultural appropriation. So all these small things add up, right? And that's this idea that you are the person that everyone should be satisfying. And then although you're not a slave, although you're not subject to gross racism where people would say you're not allowed in here because you're black, we're not having you here, right, you're inferior, you can say all of these 20 microaggressions add up to something.
Yeah.
And then you get that ludicrous situation where the guy who was running the Rhodes Must Fall campaign went over to South Africa, he was South African, had a white waitress, he'd refused to give a tip, and he wrote, "Not until you give us our land back."
Extremely.
Right? And then when she cried, he then wrote a blog about it and said, you know, they were white girls' tears, which were being used to incite white men to come to her rescue. And this was all part of the racist plot as well, and so on and so forth. It was vile behaviour of an elite posh boy treating a waitress like dirt, but somehow he was the victim of it. And somehow he was the oppressed. She was the oppressor. It's terrible to consider the lack of empathy, the lack of sensitivity of intersectionality once it gets going, because it just sticks the knife in to everybody else. It's partly because of this idea that, you know, what about me? I deserve to be given centre stage. What about my job? You know, why can't we buy houses? You know, I can't understand it when young people say we're oppressed, you know, we can't buy a house. I'm 25 and I can't afford to buy a house. I mean, I didn't buy my first house till I was 40. I mean, maybe you can't afford it. It's not an entitlement that everyone should be able to buy the house. So you see what I mean?
Yeah. I think they feel that they will never be able to buy a house, which actually, based on the housing trends, is going to be true for a lot of them. But it still doesn't justify the victimhood, in my opinion.
Yeah, but that is the logic of identity politics, that it doesn't really matter what you do on an individual level. It's about ticking the right boxes. And therefore, people would probably be reluctant to criticise this Rhodes Must Fall guy that you mentioned. He may have behaved horribly on an individual level, but he justifies it in those broader terms, saying, yeah, but I am part of this oppressed group and therefore it's fine. And then everything becomes reinterpreted in that way.
But it's also very passive, and I think that's the point. And that's part of that thing about being given things and being overprotected actually robs you of a hugely important thing. This is why I think this is a betrayal by my generation of Generation Snowflake. It's that way round, which is you've been robbed generationally of the capacity to see that that history is in your hands and that you are not a passive recipient of goods handed down from a previous generation. That's not how history should work. Your time has come, right? The young generation can now shape the world as they want to. Rather than complaining that they haven't been given what they want, go about creating the world that you want. And I think that all of these things that we've talked about, all of them, by the way, involve demands for protection. Do you know what I mean? They're not self-organising. They're demanding rules, demanding the university brings in safe space places, demanding that so-and-so is banned from campus, demanding that people are arrested because of what they've written on Twitter. It's not a kind of activity where you're taking control of your destiny. It's a demand that society organises around you, but that the grown-up people in power implement these things. And that's what's scary, because it's allowed the introduction of some quite authoritarian legislation and rules on the back of being progressive.
For more podcasts, blogs, reports and films, go to our website, iea.org.uk.